And of course, moderating the discussion is the man who created this lecture series 17 years ago. This is the end of our 17th year, by the way. He is the chairman of the Panetta Institute. Presidential decision making is a topic he knows well from his time as chief of staff to President Clinton. Please welcome our host, Secretary Leon Panetta.
Thank you. Thank you all very much, and I welcome all of you to our final forum of our lecture series this year. Our theme, as you all know, is looking at 100 years since World War I, 2014, 1914. An awful lot of history has occurred during that time. And to analyze the changes that have been made, we looked at war and peace, and the changes in that arena. We looked at the role of government, and we've also looked at the issue of freedom versus security. Tonight, we're going to look at the President of the United States and how presidents make decisions. And presidents, very frankly, influence all of those other areas that we just talked about. The President of the United States has today assumed incredible responsibilities and facing incredible pressures in that position. Since 1914, we have had 17 presidents of the United States, all of whom, you know, will have various places in history. We've gone from Wilson to Harding, Hoover to Roosevelt, Truman to Eisenhower and Nixon, Kennedy to Carter and Reagan, Johnson to Clinton, Bush, and Obama. What can we learn from all of those presidents? And how has the presidency changed in terms of the responsibilities that have to be confronted? We'll look at the challenges of the modern presidency through the eyes of four top aides. All of us have served presidents of the United States. And we have seen the qualities of what it takes for a president to be able to govern. We've seen qualities both good and bad. And I guess that's what I want to begin with, is looking at presidents that each of these individuals served. What was their greatest strength, and what was their greatest weakness? And how do you think, you know, history is going to look at them? We're talking about President Reagan, President Clinton, President Bush, and President Obama. Let's start with President Reagan. Ken?
Leon, thank you very much. Leave it to Leon and Sylvia to put together an alphabet panel. David Axelrod, A. Erskine Bowles, B. Andy Card, C. And Duberstein, D. And P for Panetta. It is an absolute thrill and a joy to be here in Monterey and with Leon and Sylvia and with all of you. Ronald Reagan's greatest strength. He knew why he ran for the presidency, and he knew what he would do once he was president. He would focus the country and the world on the United States rebuilding its economy and creating respect for America around the world. Cutting the rate of spending increase, cutting taxes, rebuilding our national security, building up to build down, and finding overburdensome regulations to eliminate. He stayed focused for all 8 years on those priorities. He was able to put in practice, along with the private sector, obviously, 18 million new jobs, an economy that he inherited that was double-digit inflation, double-digit interest rates, and America was, as Jimmy Carter said, suffering malaise. At the end of the Carter administration, most people suggested that the presidency might be too big in this modern era for any one person. They stopped saying that under Ronald Reagan and for all of us and our presidents who served thereafter. Ronald Reagan also understood that he was elected not just to make statements, but in fact to govern and get things done. He knew that in order to forge consensus in Washington, he needed to build consensus throughout America, and that would put pressure on Washington. He understood that governing, well, let me put it this way. Tip O'Neill, the venerable old Speaker of the House, used to say, I don't like compromising with Ronald Reagan, because every time I compromise with him, Reagan gets 80% of what he wants. And Ronald Reagan would say to me and Jim Baker and Ed Meese and Mike Deaver and others, well, I'll take 80% every time and come back the next year for the additional 20. That's what governing is all about, and that was a hallmark of Ronald Reagan.
Okay, so what was his weakness?
And his weakness was that he had a tendency to trust everybody. And that's why Nancy and I were the verifiers. But he trusted everybody until proven otherwise. And so you sometimes had to unwind things because they just didn't add up.
Erskine, sir, President Clinton.
You know, there's only one reason that Leon asked me to come out here. He called me up and he said, Erskine, you know, we're having this panel and I want you to talk about Bill Clinton. I said, Leon, you know everything about Bill Clinton. He said, yeah, you got it. That's why I want you to talk. You can get the phone call. I love Leon Panetta. You guys are lucky to have him. I'm telling you, everything I know. Everything I know and anything I say that you don't like, you can blame it on him because he taught me it all. Greatest strength. For me, President Clinton's greatest strength was his intellectual curiosity and his absolute ability to do the homework it takes to understand a problem from all angles, and his willingness to accept advice from people of all walks of life. You know, we could walk into the Oval Office and give him a piece of advice, and we could say red, yellow, and green, and he'd see orange, and we'd say, wow. But he could take any problem, no matter of what magnitude, and he could distill it down into a set of facts that he could communicate so that anybody could understand it. And that is a unique skill. We could have Nobel scientists in any subject coming in 2 weeks from now, and we couldn't get him to hit a lick at a snake for the first 13 days. We wouldn't do anything. But on that 14th day, you would see books from the White House Library stacked up this high on his desk. And he reads like that old Evelyn Woods reading course. I don't know how many of you remember it, but you know, reads like that. And so quickly, you can't believe it and can retain it. And then he would call people on the periphery of the subject. And you look at his phone logs that night, and he would have talked to people that you just couldn't believe. But when those people would come in, he for the first 45 minutes he'd just listen to them, but the last 15 minutes he'd say something so profound that it'd make you so proud you couldn't stand it. And it was that intellectual curiosity and willingness to do his homework and to listen to people on all sides of the subject before he made the decision.
And the weakness?
this is a quick lapse into that when he was talking. Yeah. Phone calls, so.
That was a quick, is a one word answer.
Yeah. I think that's pretty easy. Yeah.
History speaks
history,
to that.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you. You can take the 9:15 phone call.
Andy, President Bush.
George W. Bush was a man of conviction. He was very grounded. He was also very deliberate and disciplined. He's also very courageous because he has the courage to make a decision. And I would say his flaws were that he allowed there to be a myth that he couldn't read or didn't read when he was very well read and took time to read while he was president, and it was usually relevant to the responsibilities that he had. But he also kind of preferred to be from West Texas when he really was well-educated at Yale. And so he allowed there to be a perception that he wasn't as engaged as, in fact, he was. But I think the great strength of having the courage to make a decision, not allow politics to drive a decision, but to allow conscience, character, and what he thought was right for the country to give definition to the decisions that he had to make, and they were impossibly difficult decisions.
David?
Well, first of all, let me say a word about Leon as well, because I had the opportunity to serve with him, and he's really the embodiment of public service, so he's the perfect guy to be running an institute like this. I mean, a congressman, budget director, CIA director, chief of staff, Secretary of Defense, and it makes you wonder, why can't you hold a job? But Ken, I'm the director of an Institute of Politics at the University of Chicago. Ken is the chairman of one at Harvard, and the goal is very much the same, which is to try and inspire young men and women to go into careers of public service, and you're a great exemplar for them. So thank you for that. And I also see there are a lot of young servicemen and women in the audience tonight, and I want to thank you for your service as well, because you inspire all of us, so thank you. Listening to Erskine talk about President Clinton and his intellect and his intellectual curiosity was very familiar to me, because I have that same feeling about President Obama. I've never sat in a meeting where I felt that he was overmatched or unprepared, and he was as stimulated by the whole array of issues that come before a president as anybody I could imagine. But I was going to say that his strengths were that he's incredibly bright, thoughtful, and deliberative, and makes deliberative decisions. But I really think, given the history, the moment in which he served, the quality that I most admire about him was that he was willing and has been willing to make decisions that are in the best interest of the country, despite very, very negative politics, at a time when we absolutely had to make those decisions. And I think the American people tend to find leaders at the right time to make those kinds of decisions, and he made them. We lived through some terrible crises, and I always felt good to be at his side because I felt he'd get to the right answer. And regardless of the politics, and I was mostly the guy who told him the politics, and I was almost always ignored. And I admired him for that. I said earlier that I like about him best is that he listens to me so little. But I believe, Leon, that everyone's strength is often also their weakness. Mm. And so I think that the criticism of the president is the same, that he's deliberative, that he's he's thoughtful, that he's not spontaneous enough in his decision making. I think it's a good trade-off, but I would say that that is the criticism that I most often hear.
You've all mentioned crises, and in many ways, the president is really tested by crisis. What I'd like to do is to have you reflect on, what was the worst crisis that you saw the president have to handle during the time that you were there, and how did he handle it, and how will history speak to that? Erskine, let's start with you.
I think I'll go international.
That's a good place to be.
You're going to let Leon do the debate.
You know, I don't know how many of you can think back this long ago, but this is before Osama bin Laden was well known, in this country at least. And we had a chance to get him in Afghanistan once, but to do that, we had to launch some missiles and send them over Pakistan, where we had a shaky relationship at best. And since there was that shaky relationship, we wanted to make sure that we didn't alert the PACs too early so that the information that we were going after him would leak out. And so we sent the Vice Admiral at the Air Force Academy in to have dinner with the President of Pakistan. And he told him exactly 3 seconds before the missiles crossed Pakistan. And when those missiles landed, we missed bin Laden by literally minutes. And the reason I always looked at that as a decision that took some real guts is we knew that the chances were 50-50 we'd get him. Two, we ran a real chance of disrupting the relationships with a very important country that we were having to deal with. And three, this was during the time of the Monica crisis. And we also knew that if we were unsuccessful, that the Republican House and Senate would accuse us of trying to divert people's attention. And if you remember, there was a movie out there called Wag the Dog then. And of course, that's exactly what did happen. But it took a lot of guts for him to pull the trigger, and he never hesitated a second. He did it because he thought it was the right thing to do.
Well, I'm glad we were able to finish the job.
Yeah. Thank you.
Andy, crisis.
Well, first of all,
I know the headline on this one.
A president comes to office focused on what they talked about as they were campaigning to be president. And then the reality sets in when they take the oath of office. And the truth is, when they take the oath of office, they probably think more about their inaugural address than they do the oath that they took. But after the inaugural address is over, then the burdens of the job start to show up. And President Bush had significant burdens that showed up. Remember the Chinese forcing a plane down on Hunan Island. Mm-hmm. And how was he going to react? What was going to happen? Now, not a crisis. It could have been. He managed it well by being restrained and listening and seeking counsel and making phone calls. The Chinese were very slow to answer them. But then you have other crises that come. I don't want to say you never anticipate them. They're usually storms. And probably the greatest crisis that caused the greatest concern for the president was Hurricane Katrina. And the frustration with that crisis was that the president alone does not dictate the response. Under our laws, the Federal Emergency Management Agency must find a request from a governor to offer support. And that request has to follow a particular protocol that Congress outlines, the Stafford Act. And we had a hard time getting one governor to make the right response or the right question or ask for the right information. And yet the public only sees the president's response. They don't really appreciate, I'm going to say, the governor's response. So that was frustrating. But probably the greatest crisis that any president faces, and I pray the presidents don't have to face this crisis, but too many do, how do you have to meet your constitutional responsibilities on a policy that you did not invite, but it requires the president to keep an oath that he cannot keep without the fine men and women who take other oaths to help him keep his oath and call him into service? And that's going to war. And any time a young man is or a young woman is put into harm's way and they're invited to make sacrifices that the president would never invite on anyone, it's a burden the president takes. And going to war is always a crisis. And that weighs heavily on the president. And I watched it weigh very, very heavily on President George W. Bush, and I watched it weigh heavily on his dad as well. So I would say that's the crisis, one that the law doesn't allow you to respond the way you would like to, a hurricane, and another one that the Constitution says you have the sole responsibility to respond, but you can't do it yourself. You have to count on other people to make sacrifices, and that burden ends up being the burden.
David?
Well, since bin Laden is taken, the truth is, for better or worse, there are a lot of crises to choose from under this presidency, and it's not over yet. But look, on December 16, 2008, we got together with the president-elect and the vice president-elect just a few weeks after we celebrated in Grant Park for the first time with his economic team together. And they gave us a briefing on the state of the economy. And Christina Romer, who was going to be head of the Council of Economic Advisors, spoke first. She was an expert on the Great Depression, and she went through all our charts. And at the end, she said, "Mr. President, I think that we're in the midst of a recession that's going to be as deep as anything we've faced since the Great Depression." Larry Summers, coming in as head of the National Economic Council, talked about what that would mean for the economy, $1 trillion hole in the economy in 2009, $1 trillion hole in 2010, millions of jobs lost. Tim Geithner spoke, Treasury Secretary incoming, and said the system is locked up and it could collapse. No loans are being given. And then to cheer everybody up, your old colleague Peter Orszag, the incoming budget director, said, "And this will add, this and the steps we need to take to deal with it will add significantly to the debt and deficits." So at this point, the president entertained and dismissed the notion of asking for a recount. and what began was we basically became a triage unit trying to right the economy. In the quarter before we took office, the economy shrunk by 8.9%, the worst quarter since 1930. We were losing 800,000 jobs a month. The stock market was headed to 6,500. We had millions of foreclosures. And it was the worst situation any president had faced since Roosevelt in 1933. And what followed was a Recovery Act, a large spending program at a time when people were concerned about deficits, but necessary to plug the hole in the economy. We had to take steps to stand up the financial industry, which was reviled at the time for the role they had played or perceived to have played in the financial crisis and the train wreck of the economy. And the U.S. auto industry was on the brink, and we Chrysler and GM were on the weeks away from bankruptcy. And so you add all those things together, and so we had to step in and save them. And none of these steps were popular. They were all difficult, but they were what his responsibility required, and he took them, and he took them with eyes open, knowing that the politics were bad. And he never once really asked about the politics and wouldn't allow us to foist the politics on him, because this was what he was elected to do.
President Reagan.
Just a few quick vignettes. As much as Reagan became beloved during the campaign of 1980, I think the country really fell in love with him when they saw the grace and dignity and humor after the assassination attempt, which is clearly a major first crisis of the administration. Who can forget President Reagan as he was being wheeled in the gurney at GW Hospital, saying, "I hope all you doctors are Republicans." The other part of that story is the surgeon leaned down and said, "Today we are all Republicans." Or having seen Nancy for the first time, saying, "Honey, I forgot the duck." But that caught on with the American people. Another crisis is when we lost the Challenger. And Ronald Reagan became the chaplain to the country. in those, that most eloquent address, comforting America on the loss of those wonderful astronauts. And then there was Reykjavik, where Ronald Reagan was accused of walking away from a deal on a strategic arms negotiation with Mikhail Gorbachev because he would have had to sacrifice his SDI, Strategic Defense Initiative program, which he thought would keep more pressure on the Soviet Union. He was criticized, but ultimately he was proved right because it got Gorbachev back to the table. The next one that I want to mention quickly. Everybody knows the signature line of the Reagan years, his visit to the Berlin Wall. But let me suggest to you that it wasn't that easy. The State Department and the national security folks all opposed that one paragraph in the speech because they thought it would undercut Gorbachev's efforts on perestroika and glasnost. I showed the speech and the offending paragraph to the president. And he said, "What do you think?" And I said, "I think it's a hell of a line. But you're president, you get to decide." And he called me back an hour later to come back to the Oval Office. And he said, "I think we'll leave it in." And I explained the objections of the National Security Council people and the State Department. And Ronald Reagan said, "No, this will help define Gorbachev and put him even more strongly toward bargaining and negotiation." We went to Berlin. The night before, there had been massive riots against the United States because we had put Pershing 2 missiles in Germany and elsewhere. George Shultz called me on the phone and said, "Will you tell the president that I share my department's objection to the speech, to that paragraph in the speech, and I hope you will convey my views to the president?" And as everybody on this panel knows, when a cabinet secretary doesn't ask for 10 minutes on the president's calendar, but asks you to convey the information, it means I've covered myself with the bureaucracy. And if the line fails and there's a major world crisis, it's on your shoulders. We've all had that experience. As President Reagan and I were driving to the Brandenburg Gate in the presidential motorcade, he was reviewing his speech one more time. And he got to that paragraph, and he turned to me and said, "It's going to drive the State Department boys crazy, but I'm going to leave it in. Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall." Ronald Reagan fundamentally ended the Cold War and brought Gorbachev to the bargaining table, so we got a strategic arms negotiation.
That's great.
Crisis.
But since I was a chief of staff, I'll give you a small little element. When I had just gotten appointed chief of staff, and I was home, this was about 2 o'clock, 2:30 in the morning, and I got a call from Secret Service. And Secret Service said, "Mr. Panetta," because when you get a call at that time of the evening, it's not good news. So he said, "Mr. Panetta, sorry to tell you, but a plane just went into the White House." And I said, "Well, what the hell was it, a 747, or, what kind of plane went into the White House?" He said, "No, it's a light plane. It went up against the White House. We think it may have damaged the Jackson magnolia tree, but it didn't do much damage." And I said, well, wait a minute. This could be a terrorist attack on the president. Have you looked in the plane? Is there, explosives in the plane? And the answer was, well, according to CNN News,
True.
And I said, no, I'd appreciate it if you get off your butt and go out there and check the plane to make sure that it not happened the first time.
If it makes you feel good, there's a great story that Colin Powell tells. Being at a wedding in a church, he was national security advisor. An aide comes during the service, the ceremony, and says, there's an urgent phone call for you. And all everybody's eyes follow the National Security Council directors as he leaves the church. And he comes back 10 minutes later. And Alma Powell leans over to him and says, what's going on? And Colin says, well, there's been a coup in X country. She said, oh, I heard that on CNN before we left. Yeah.
But Leon, I think all of us, we should also underscore that while we can pick iconic sort of crises right. and challenges, I mean, what makes the presidency what it is that every single day is filled with, I can guarantee you that when we were running for president, we didn't talk a lot about pirates. That was something that came up later, and all of a sudden, the president has 10 minutes to decide whether or not he should give the order to try and take out Captain Phillips' captors.
That's right.
And he had snipers bobbing on a boat who were pretty sure they could get the bad guys, but might get Captain Phillips, and he's got 10 minutes to decide. And, or someone walks in the office when you're dealing with a financial crisis and a war and tells you that we may have a H1N1 pandemic, I mean, that is the nature of the presidency. And that's why it is such an incredibly challenging job.
Andy, let me ask you about that, because, it's the whole question of what is the process that a president uses to come to a decision? We've heard a little bit of it discussed here, but here presidents have to face countless decisions on administrative issues, on legislative issues, on as commander in chief, on foreign policy, political decisions, et cetera, et cetera. What's the process that the president uses in order to come to a decision? I mean, the perceptions are these. Reagan kind of had this core set of beliefs that Ken talked about. Clinton kind of reached out for every view. You talked about that. Bush kind of, we thought, operated by his gut. Obama, the law professor's approach. What was the process that you saw a president use in order to come to a decision?
Well, first I want to say that it's up to the chief of staff to know the president, the personality, what their thinking process is, and you want to make sure the president, in my opinion, I wanted to always make sure the president was never making a decision when he was hungry, angry, lonely, or tired. and since that's 24 hours a day, it's a burden. I also want him to make a decision in the best possible mood he could be in. I didn't want a pessimistic president making a decision. I wanted it to be an optimistic decision, even though it was brutally tough. So I focused on the president's lifestyle, and it's a 24-hour, 7-day-a-week responsibility for the chief of staff, because you don't know when he has to make a decision. So you want him to be in the best possible mood. So I did focus on every minute of every day, 7 days a week, 24 hours a day, and tried to make sure the president could be as prepared as possible when we didn't know what he had to be prepared to do. But ultimately, the president would try not to allow emotions to drive the response. He would seek counsel that was not monolithic. So I would make sure that he wasn't getting monolithic counsel. He was getting information to be able to make a decision rather than be presented a decision. And I wanted to make sure that he understood when the decision was necessary, whether it was in 10 minutes or 2 hours or 6 days or 3 months. And give the president an opportunity then to adjust the process that he had to go through to make a decision in time. Because if you make the decision too late, it's irrelevant. If you make it too early, it may not be mature the way it should have been at the time the decision was put into motion. So I tried to pay attention to, kind of Goldilocks and the Three Bears. I was always looking for the perfect porridge to feed him. But I think ultimately the president had to be comforted that he had the information the best information available at the time from people who he could trust but were not just feeding him a response. And he had to understand the constraints that were there. What are the consequences of the decision being made too early or too late? And what are the consequences to the decision if it's wrong? And so that's the process that I would go through. But probably whispering into the president's ear on 9/11 is the best example of delivering a message that the president didn't expect to hear. When I told him that a second plane hit the second tower, America was under attack, it wasn't a statement that he expected to hear from his chief of staff, sitting in front of second grade students with an audience of press pool folks watching every move. And I couldn't present him the information and ask to have a discussion or enter into a dialogue. I had to drop a message and then back off and let him accept that message and wrestle with what his constitutional responses would be and how he should respond. Well, I tried to give him all of the tools in the other room where the staff was busy getting ready to help the president do his job.
Erskine?
You know, people used to ask me all the time, was this TV show, The West Wing, was it accurate? And I said, well, you know, it does a pretty good job of capturing the velocity of the place. It's like faster than the dot-com world. And the breadth of issues you have to deal with in a day. You know, in an average day for Leon and for me, you know, we deal with Bosnia, Northern Ireland, taxation, the budget, some kind of environmental issue, and then we'd have lunch. and, you know, we always said, you know, thank God it's Friday, only two more work days till Monday. And, you know, if you were doing one of these Sunday shows, God, you know, you know all the stuff you would have done on Saturday, you know, you had to do on Sunday. So it really was a seven-day-a-week job. But I think what this guy next to me did when he came into the White House was remarkable. Leon came in and brought Harold Ickes and myself in as his two deputies. And when we arrived, we saw a White House where every 15 minutes of every day was scheduled. And you can imagine in a world that's changing and evolving as much as the one these guys described, you know, clearly if you have every 15 minutes scheduled, it gives you no time to think, reflect, and react to a changing world. And it also means that you're going to be or appear to be late to meeting after meeting when it's really just poor staff work. The second thing that Leon and I saw was we had some members of the staff, I know this will come as a great surprise to you guys, who were leaking what was going on in various meetings they weren't even in.
Never stopped.
And one of the purposes of that was to lock the president into where they wanted him to go as opposed to where he might want to go. And therefore, if he actually made the opposite decision, that it looked like he flip-flopped. And finally, we found a White House where people would wander into the Oval Office, the president would get a little information here, a little information there, and it'd take him longer to make worse decisions. And so Leon changed that. He made sure that the president got all his information in context. We freed up 3 to 4 hours every single day for him to think, reflect, and react to a changing world. And we made sure that in theory that less is often better than more, that instead of doing 2 to 3 events a day and therefore stepping on his message he was trying to get out, that he would do maybe 2 a week, and that if he was saying something in New York that was quite important, that instead of having Bob Reich and Bob Rubin saying the exact opposite thing in New Orleans and New Mexico, that they all said the same thing. And that way we were able to get control. We were able to establish some discipline, some organization, structure, and focus. And the president went on to have a successful second year.
Ken?
Erskine reminds me about West Wing. And I had the privilege of being a consultant for Storyline for 3 years. The first time I went out to Hollywood, I met with 7 writers, none of whom was more than 35 years of age, and only 2 of the 7 had ever been in Washington. And I spent several hours as we started to chart out the year. And at the end, I said I had to go back to Washington. And this wonderful, very pretty young writer, woman, got up and gave me a hug. And one of the male writers said, Mr. Duberstein, immediately making me feel old, said, do you know how lucky you are? No. She's never kissed a Republican before in her life. Everybody walks into the Oval Office, almost everybody, and gets cotton in their mouth. They tell the president what they think he wants to hear, not what he needs to know. The job that all of us had was to be the reality therapist, to say, it doesn't add up. Everybody walks into the Oval Office, almost everybody, and says, you know, Mr. President, it's in your best interest to do this. And our job was to figure out why it was in their best interest first and the president second. Ronald Reagan was a voracious reader. He read all the memos, all the decision memos we all talked about. But the key to Reagan was listening to the arguments in person, because an actor, he looked at people's eyes, he heard their tone, and he could start sorting out what really added up and what didn't. He never liked the argument, Mr. President, this is the best politics for you. He would end the conversation. The answer was, make sure at our level that he had the right options, and then let them argue it out, those people argue it out in front of him in the Oval Office, and then later he would make a decision.
David?
Well, I think, and we've all sort of, some of it has to do with the input, right? So there's so much information, and part of the staff's job is to filter the information, but filter it fairly so that he gets a feel for the sweep of arguments. And, you know, Obama, I mean, one of the things that has been very good for him in the presidency is that he had been a legislator for 11 years before he became president. And so he was either in Springfield or Washington much of the time. This was the first time in his life that he was actually living with his family on a regular basis. And so he would go home every night at 6:30 to have dinner with his family. And then he would dive into this thick folder and well into the night, reviewing all of the stuff for the next day. And he was always well briefed on what was in that package. But as Ken suggests, I think the conversations were very important to him. And Leon, you're asking a question that you know the answer to, sure, because you were involved in many of these conversations. You say he has a law professor's instincts, in the sense that he drills down into these issues. That's true, but there's a sort of dispassionate implication to that that wasn't true. He was very well aware of the implications of his decisions, and he wanted to hear people argue them out. And as you know, it was, if he was in, whoever was in the room, he presumed they were there for a reason, and he wanted to know what everybody thought. He didn't just want one dominant voice to speak, but he wanted to hear the discussions. And then when he thought he had enough information, he would make a decision.
Yeah, no, it was, I mean, again, just from my own insights, when we were looking at the bin Laden decision, the reality is we did not have 100% intelligence that bin Laden was there, and it was considered a pretty risky operation. And when we went to the National Security Council, many in the National Security Council said it was too risky and that we shouldn't do it. And so, you know, he continued to go around. And I remember when he asked me, I said, you know, Mr. President, I have an old formula that I use when I was in Congress, which was, you know, if I'm facing a tough decision, ask the average citizen in my district, what would you do if you knew what I did? And I thought, if I told the average citizen that we had the best intelligence on the location of bin Laden since Tora Bora, that I think the average citizen would say, you have to do it. You can't make the mistake of not taking this on. And I told the president that, and I said, in addition to that, I have tremendous confidence in the ability of the SEALs to conduct this operation. And the president didn't make a decision at that point. But the next day, he called and said, it's a go. You know, which tells you, you know, you just got to weigh that through at that point. Let me ask, you're all members of presidents who were elected to a second term. And the second term, you know, frankly, turns out to be pretty rough. It's a bumpy ride. Things catch up to you, you know, in the last 4 years that you didn't have to worry about the first 4 years. You know, for Reagan, Iran-Contra, Clinton, obviously, Lewinsky, Bush, Iraq, Katrina, you talked about that, Obama, health care, veterans care.
You're bumming everybody out, Leon.
Yeah.
How does a president stay relevant in the second term, and not seem like, you know, basically things are going to happen without the president directing policy in the country? I mean, how does the president stay relevant? Let me ask you, David.
Well, first of all, let me say that I think presidents today have an even more difficult task because of the pace at which the media churns. Mm. And it is so easy to be overexposed because of the way the media churns and people get tired. You know, we live in a society where people are always looking for new and they get tired. And by 6 years, you know, you have to deal with that element. And then we've got the kind of deep polarization that we have today. So it's difficult for any president, certainly been difficult for this president. But on the question of relevance, I think this is a serendipitous day to talk about this because the president signed an order today on emissions from coal-fired plants that is pretty profound in its implications. And I'm sure will be very controversial as well. But no one could argue that it wasn't a meaningful act or gesture. It was a very important one, and I think it'll go down in the sort of annals of this discussion on climate change as a big step forward. So I think that you have to use the tools that are available to you to advance the things that you feel are important. The other element, by the way, on this is, and this is a failing of our political system, we now have a permanent election campaign. We have elections with a few weeks of governing as an interlude, and then more elections. And so part of what happens is people get bored because this president is going to be running anymore. So they're already thinking about, and you may ask us about it, what about the next presidential election? This guy's like yesterday's news. So that's something else, you know, in this environment in which we're constantly churning about elections and politics, it makes it hard for a second-term president.
Andy?
The second term is always a challenge. George W. Bush had the challenge of trying to get some of his favorite programs passed. He called for Social Security reform and wasn't able to build the momentum. He called for immigration reform, wasn't able to build the momentum. Obviously, he was dealing with two wars, and he was trying to manage a transition. We had actually kind of won the hot war, and were losing winning the peace. We couldn't win the peace. And so those were challenges. But then he had the crisis in our economy that hit after the Republican and the Democratic conventions, after the two nominees of the major parties had already been selected, and we had an economic crisis, and he had to deal with that. So he did not have a lot of positive momentum going to get anything done with Congress or to mobilize interest, never mind support, from the American people. He was trying to clean up two wars, help secure peace in two places that didn't want to embrace peace, and then he had an economic crisis that very few people anticipated would come. I think that what he did do was manage with a calm deliberance, and he was a partner in a transition. And yes, President George W. Bush and Barack Obama, very different philosophies, obviously different parties, but President Bush really worked hard to make sure that President Obama wasn't given, an empty basket to play with. He actually told him what was in the basket. So he focused on the transition. And he actually started to do that quite early. And it was probably the most orderly transition in the history
of
our country.
Well, I've said, you know this, Andy, because I've said this to you. I will always be profoundly grateful for the way the transition was handled. Not only was the president generous to President Obama, but all of our counterparts were generous to us in terms of briefing us on their jobs and bringing us up to date on things that were relevant for us moving forward. So I was proud of the I was not grateful to him. And proud of our country because of the way that transition was handled. Because, you know, frankly, we had beaten the bejesus out of him in our campaign. I mean, it was we were very critical of his policies, and it said something about our country that, despite all that, now we did have one. We did work together on something very important at the end of that administration. You mentioned the financial crisis.
But also the intelligence side.
Right. But on the after Lehman collapsed, you know, Hank Paulson, the Treasury Secretary, had reached out beforehand to brief Obama. And Obama was as supportive as he could be in terms of trying to rally Democrats and hold Democrats together for that solution. And so, you know, I'm going to break all this comedy with a T and make one partisan point, which is, Democrats in large numbers came to the support of President Bush on the TARP, which was a very tough vote because there was it was a time of crisis for the country. And I think that was a good example that's worth following.
Well, so my transition was that the second term is about getting ready to pass the baton. And a good president will make sure the baton is not dropped the day that it's passed. And I think that that's a very important thing to do when you are a lame duck president, getting ready to support a new president that you may or may not like, but you will respect.